This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, you're listening to Good Things, the show where we speak to good people who are doing good things. I'm Dashran Johan. Doctors on Ground, also known as DNG, is a medical non-profit organization championing sustainability in community development and healthcare to marginalized groups in Malaysia. Though only established in 2021, the organization has already assisted close to 700 families across the country. So joining me on the show today to talk about DNG is its founder, Arisa Jemima Ikram. Welcome to the show, Arisa. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me about this organization and the work that y'all do.
Essentially, Doctors on Ground is an independent humanitarian organization. We deliver medical assistance and aid to refugees and other marginalized communities. And we aspire to basically provide sustainable solutions towards humanitarian healthcare and other community development programs. What that looks like is clinics and community projects, and even home visits to patients.
What role, Arisa, do you play in the organization? Because as far as I'm aware, you're not a medical doctor, right?
No, I am not. I am a final year student in international relations and international law. Yeah, so I act as the founder and executive director, and that's basically a fancy word for someone who makes all the big decisions on policy, on operations, and project planning within the organization itself. But besides that, I also take up casework. So I sometimes do casework with the medical team, and this is primarily because even prior to me starting any NGO, you know, I was a caseworker. And to this day, I do still take up individual cases. I think the only difference now is that I have doctors and specialists who I can just directly consult with. So I think when you put that all together, that's almost 3 years' experience on the ground,
absolutely.
Managing patients. And I think in that time, I'm definitely bound to pick up some knowledge on responding to medical situations. I think it goes back to the very concept of if I am going to be on ground or if I'm going to send someone on ground, they have to be the most useful person there. So I think with DNG, having limited volunteers that are effective on ground is a very common thing. So for example, I think in Sabah, it was only Dr. Jivita and I, you know, who were stationed up at rural clinics. I think the few nights before the actual project, I would, and Dr. Jivita can definitely quote me on this, I would stay up all night and memorize the medication lists. I'd memorize the what they were for, because I needed to find a way to assist Dr. Jivita in the best ways possible. Mm-hmm. I'm actually quite good at taking patient history now. So I think that even that ability is extremely useful on ground. There is and always has been this notion that I need to be a medical doctor, you know, to run a medical nonprofit. And you know, to the extent of medical intervention, you know, at home surgeries or prescription or procedures, yes, you know, it definitely does make sense to have a doctor leading the charge. Mm-hmm. And within that capacity, you know, Dr. Jivita is there as our chief medical officer, and we have other doctors as well that oversee that entire area. But I think in my defense and in the defense of the kind of conversation that we're having, you know, I identified the gaps of healthcare not as a medical doctor, you know, but as someone who is quite well versed in international humanitarian politics. So I think it's also important to, you know, acknowledge that some of the most ineffective volunteers that work with us on ground are sometimes medical doctors and students, you know, and some of the best are non-medical. our network is extremely diverse. You know, we have a bunch of volunteers who come from different backgrounds and different expertise. And I think my personal goal of redesigning or contributing to the redesign of the future of healthcare, especially for marginalized communities in, you know, mm-hmm. LMICs, low middle income countries, it requires the intervention and you know, the assistance of people outside of the sector, because essentially healthcare is not only about the pharma industry, it's economic, it's political, you know, it's
absolutely
even town planning. You can talk about it, yeah, in the context of education, national security. You know, they are the healthcare industry is inextricably related to public and foreign policies, and that's why it's so important to have people from different backgrounds.
Yeah, totally. Why did you decide to start this initiative? Was there a sort of light bulb moment in which you went, okay, this needs to be done right now?
I started off as a volunteer. So this is prior to anything at all. So when the COVID happened, the COVID pandemic happened, I actually started off as a regular volunteer with a bunch of different NGOs. Mm-hmm. And that transitioned very, very quickly to casework, to individual casework, because there was no one at that time that was ready to take up that kind of capacity. So my first case was actually the home birth of a Rohingya woman. And she was about 21 years old. She was much younger than I was, who basically, due to financial constraints and a very visible fear to go to the hospital, had no intention at all of admitting not only herself but her newborn son. You know, so
right.
So at that time, it is. So at that time, especially for someone who. She was living in Selayang, so it wasn't like she was in some rural city. Mm. You know, the closest hospital was 10 minutes away. So the goal on my end at that time was to get her hospitalized, to get her checked by a medical team in Hospital Selayang. And after weeks of back and forth from Shah Alam to Selayang, you know, fighting with nurses, because that was when I actually saw the very real problems, and also, you know, fundraising through friends and family. Were we able to hospitalize her and have her discharged? So that experience alone, you know, through that experience alone, I could pinpoint three things. You know, number one, that government servants working in hospitals, especially government hospitals, can sometimes be very cruel, especially to women. Mm. You know, secondly, to a point where it disrupts the patient's in intention to seek treatment. So that's number one. Mm. Number two, the topic of health promotion and financing needs desperate intervention. You know, there wasn't enough going around to help finance a lot of the medical issues that refugees, primarily who were in Selayang, were facing. And thirdly, you know, family planning and contraceptives, especially for the Rohingya and Myanmar Muslim refugees, that was being overlooked by both government and private sectors. And it was a very real problem. I think much later on, that's when I kind of founded an NGO that works on women empowerment. And
right.
Through that organization, I basically was able to kind of develop a very small department that specifically addresses healthcare. And within that capacity, I was then able to dabble a little on navigating navigating humanitarian healthcare without the pressure of, you know, starting an entire organization specifically about healthcare. I think so. Right. So I basically had about 6 months in an internship with my first organization to kind of start kind of explore humanitarian healthcare before, you know, realizing, okay, if I'm going to do this effectively, I need a proper team and I need an organization that acknowledges that healthcare is the primary goal. So Doctors on Ground was born about 6 months later. I think even now, you know, DNG is starting to identify that there are so many other factors that contribute to our community's health. Like I mentioned before, it's mm-hmm. not just checkups and medication. You know, it's a lot. A lot of it is what I've basically built in my first NGO. You know, so a lot of that was basically transferred to DNG. Because things like literacy, things like environmental health, even community politics, you know, they all play a role in determining the overall picture of healthcare.
Right. And let's hone in on that a little bit, because Malaysia, thankfully, we still have affordable healthcare. You can even get major surgeries done for a couple of hundred ringgit and things like that, our public hospitals. But what are the problems faced by communities you serve, the marginalized communities, in terms of healthcare?
Yeah, for starters, discrimination to an extent that is all very, very familiar has definitely the power to discourage anyone, you know, from seeking treatment. On DNGs, and we see the scale and the domino effect of a system that discriminates against a specific population. You know, people are fearful from stigmatization, bullying, and that could basically end up having them resort to other means of treatment. So I think in the example of the use and dependency of traditional medicine is something that we see in our Pahang and Selayang communities. And one of the factors contributing to this is obviously discrimination, you know, and the use and dependency of traditional medicine. It basically leads to hesitation towards and a fear towards modern medicine. And if that is expanded on a wider scale, then it could lead to a sort of resistance, especially when it comes to us coming in and addressing public health outbreaks. I think one of the examples that I could illustrate is our vaccination program in Borneo. You know, there was a genuine disinterest, you know, to engage and participate in our program, and that is because the population that we were working with were the stateless. So they have, for the longest time, been excluded from the national health system. And it's even more political to work. It's extremely political to work with the stateless, even more so than refugees in Selayang. Right. When we were in Borneo, we couldn't even talk about it at one point. You know, similarly, even in the clinics in Pahang, who, you know, we work with local orang aslis in Pahang, you know, and our patients just kept running away and hiding in their houses because they were afraid of the medical team. You know, they didn't like all of the fancy bottles of medicine that we brought them.
I can imagine it must be scary for them, right? It is. Because they're not familiar. Yeah,
exactly. So I think it is rooted back to the discrimination and fear. And another gap is access to primary and preventive medicine. Right, as well as health promotion and health literacy, you know, especially among the marginalized. I think that entire sector is still massively being overlooked. You know, we are obviously seeing the potential of private sectors coming in and addressing this. So we're seeing you know, the private sector come in and work with government sectors to address the lack of primary and preventive medicine. I think another thing that is good to highlight when we are talking about the healthcare system is, I think it's generally understood that the Malaysian healthcare system is greatly understaffed, is chronically underfunded, you know, and quite frankly, it doesn't have enough resources to meet the healthcare demands of not only refugees, but also, you know, the Malaysian people. And I think it's also why DNG has been extremely vocal in the Hartal doctor contract and Hausman issue, you know, because we acknowledge that when the issue is as systemic as it is, that will definitely translate to the ground very quickly. And the first people who are going to feel it is obviously the marginalized first on even just the topic of affordability.
Right.
It's quite difficult to justify that it's affordable, especially when you're trying to serve it to a population that doesn't have access to legal employment, or even just any population. It could be local, whose employment opportunities are limited geographically simply because they live in a state that is underdeveloped or that does not provide enough opportunities, and they do not have the capacity to move out and search for better opportunities. And that's something that we saw in Kedah when we were working with the B40 Malaysians there. So I think on that note as well, on the note of affordability, it comes hand in hand with accessibility, you know. So again, like I said, DNG has worked with B40 and Orang Asli communities, and communities who definitely find it much more difficult to access healthcare services. I think next month, late June, we'll be sending out a team to areas in Borneo that are extremely remote. So we do dabble in rural healthcare and community medicine simply because the local healthcare system just does not have the capacity to maintain that outreach. So those are very real. Those are the gaps and realities that are being faced by in the Malaysian healthcare system.
On the show with me today is Arisa Jemima Ikram, founder of Doctors on Ground. After the break, I ask her what are some of the biggest lessons she's learned so far from serving marginalized communities. Keep it here on Good Things, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Good Things. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today is Arisa Jemima Ikram, founder of Doctors on Ground. So, Arisa, you guys have accomplished a lot in a very short period of time, because DNG only started in 2021. But according to some reports, DNG has already provided assistance in medical funding and medical aid to over 700 families across 8 states in Malaysia. That's in a period of just about a year. How did you accomplish so much in so little time?
Yeah, it is quite amazing, isn't it? And it's almost
really
a flex.
Is.
Yeah,
it, really is.
It feels good to go around and say, "Ha! In under a year, we did so much," and it feels good. I think one of our strategic values is being a good stewards of limited resources. We understand that there is an increasing need of medical assistance and aid. So it's very important to navigate our resources effectively. I think one of the things that I got to do with DNG that I wasn't able to do with any of my previous associations was basically prove that, you know, it shouldn't take 6 months of planning and 100,000 ringgit to run a project with the community. It always starts with the first step. Basically, you know, you send out a recce team, you get ground intel, and you work with what you have. So when Dr. Jivita and I started taking on Borneo in January, we took that on this year. You know, we were completely self-funded. You know, so we basically just brought over the donated medication that we had left from our inventory, and we became the recce team, and we set out that little clinic. I think on that note, it also accounts to my background as a caseworker, you know, and just the belief that if you are going to run your teams successfully, or if you're going to run humanitarian projects, you need to be able to know what's going on ground for you to relay that back. Yeah, so your your knowledge on the ground is only limited to your access there, you know, and that's one of the reasons why I've been frontlining most of our programs, you know, even under my previous NGO, you know, it was important that as someone who intends to push out projects for the community, it was important that I meet the community itself, that I have seen for myself what it's like on ground. Because a lot of the times, if we're getting reports just from here and there, it doesn't really reflect the complete reality of what's happening.
Right. What have been some of the biggest challenges so far in setting up and running DNG? Because, you know, this isn't something that you are doing full time. In the sense that you are a final year student, you also co-founded Women for Refugees, and then now Doctors on Ground. What has been the biggest challenges in setting this organization up?
In the beginning, mm-hmm. It was definitely I definitely had to take a few steps to just you know, convince everyone that I could run a medical NGO, regardless of how many years of experience I had, you know. Right. And I think accounting to what I mentioned before, you know, everyone was at that point, everyone was just too focused on the fact that I wasn't a doctor. And that definitely played with my head a little. It made me work harder and demand more from my teams. And then that's one of the reasons why we were able to expand so fast. But also acknowledging the fact that DNG was born in the pandemic. You know, and it mm-hmm. has always become our reality, you know, to be so fast paced with our planning and always on crisis management mode. Because when we are working with healthcare, you know, if it is urgent, it can't be delayed. So that's another challenge, you know, getting the teams used to something that is very fast paced, very ad hoc sometimes. For example, Bungie. You know, I think DNG handled it quite well because our teams are used to, at that point of time, our teams were used to the very fast-paced kind of work situation.
Right.
Yeah. So I think that was one of the challenges that I had to oversee on team management. Another thing was definitely, you know, financing and securing resources, not only for our beneficiaries, but also for our teams. Because like I said, you know, being born in the pandemic, you have to set aside a budget that could get your teams the protection gear and test kits that they needed, especially during the very hot season of COVID. You know, so at one point we were spending quite a lot of money on PPEs, on other protection gear. I think in Sabah, when we went there, about 20% of our inventory was just for the very special PPE, the one that you literally have to suit up like an astronaut. Yeah, because we obviously try to take the highest precaution. So that's right. One thing that we definitely had to look at. I think another challenge that we saw and that I actually very recently started to realize is the dependence on other parties. So, for example, DNG provides medical assistance, right? And if in the case we need food supplies or our communities need food supplies, we would obviously outsource that service to another NGO that can provide food supplies, because DNG is not in the capacity to provide food supplies. Or even during Bungie, you know, we needed teams to come in who could help clean the houses that were affected. And DNG did not have the capacity to do that. So I think it's only now that I'm sort of realizing where, you know, partnerships that are not reliable or are a bit too political with their work, you know, it puts us on a halt if they are not going right. to provide us food or something in that capacity. So I think that's why mm-hmm. DNG is looking to just expand its border a bit more so that we don't have to depend on external aid for food or for other supplies that our communities need. We don't have to justify why refugees need food and healthcare at the same time. Yeah, so that's definitely one of the long-term goals on our end to, you know, mm-hmm. to create subsections within our NGO that could provide and supply all of the demands of the community.
I think that's absolutely fantastic. Arisa, I want to talk to you a little bit about you personally, because you are someone who is clearly very passionate about social justice. When did you develop this passion? Was it something that your parents and your family talked about while you were growing up, or things like that?
Okay, so I started with animal rights, where I wanted to be a veterinarian when I was quite young. And then I shifted towards the environment and climate change. And I think it was only in 2018 that I got involved in war, in politics, and yes, eventually human rights. My dad was actually very anti-establishment. He was very anti-West. You know, he loved Che Guevara and Fidel Castro, and was basically obsessed. Yeah, he was obsessed with the Vietnam War. So, and he was extremely knowledgeable in international politics and history. So that's one end of the aisle. My mom, on the other hand, she's a sweetheart. You know, she's very much a humanitarian. You know, in her time, she volunteered for the Red Cross. She wanted to become a doctor. Even now, she has her own little NGO going, you know, which I kind of oversee from time to time. Yeah, so and she's incredibly smart and very, very much someone that I look up to. But, you know, with those very aggressive backgrounds, my parents never brought their opinions on social justice, you know, in family conversation. You know, I only found out their, you know, their personal passions of humanitarian warfare and volunteering through things lying around in the house. You know, I see war journals and medical books. I have a whole collection of Che Guevara and just Cuba and the Vietnam War.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, and I'd have like my dad would write little notes here and there. You know, in the longest run, you kind of start to connect the dots that, hey, maybe, you know, my dad was a little crazy. So that's
crazy in a good way.
Crazy in the best way. Yes.
Yes. You know, how has your parents reacted to you? You know, essentially, like you said, like they never spoke about these things during family dinners necessarily, but now you are, you know, out helping the marginalized communities. You're trying to empower them. You're very passionate about activism. How has your parents reacted towards all of this?
I think I do have to account my mom and family to for the support that they've given. You know, I sometimes DNG is all I can think about. I prioritize it sometimes even more than I prioritize my degree. and everything else, sometimes I don't go to family dinners because I have a meeting. And they are so supportive and understanding, even within that capacity. Even in our house, you know, there are areas in our house that are literally sectioned off for inventory and ERISA stuff, do not touch. So I think that support alone is the one thing that has allowed me to do what I do. You know, I'm a very ambitious and indecisive person. And I think my mom is extremely supportive. So I went from wanting to become a war correspondent, and now I want to do medicine and work as a field surgeon. So I think my mom kind of is ready for that massive jump into different industries, but she makes me understand that if you're going to do it, finance yourself, number one, and make sure you're good at it, you know, put in the hard work. So I think that support and that understanding alone has basically allowed me to kind of paint the foundations of what I'm really going to do, especially when it does come to my humanitarian ambitions.
Absolutely wonderful. What are some of the lessons you've learned? Because you've been doing this for about 3-4 years now. What are some of the biggest lessons you've learned while serving the marginalized communities?
I think number one, it's very easy to commit to a bubble of ignorance. So prior to going on ground and starting my NGOs, you know, I was already studying international politics and the refugee crisis just on my own. I was studying it for about almost 2 years. And even that wasn't enough to kind of prepare me for what I was about to see on ground. And that is because the realities are always shifting. Now, and I always have to make sure that I am in the position of learning new things and open to learning. But I think on that point, at the same time, you know, I also have to just credit my years of experience and god-awful work that I've put in to confidently make decisions, especially concerning our communities, you know, basically mm-hmm. trusting myself and my gut instinct to sometimes say no to certain collaborations and opportunities that is designed to put the communities that I work with in harm's way. So I think that's another thing that I've definitely realized as well. It also took me a while to kind of understand that, you know, while the refugee crisis can be so overwhelming, it shouldn't take a lot to make that first step. You know, it's very, very easy. And I always get this for anyone to basically minimize your effort or whatever you're doing. But I think as long as you and your team acknowledge the value in the work that you guys are doing, I think you'll be bulletproof for the rest of the year.
How can the public support DNG? What kind of support do y'all need? And is there anything listeners can do to help?
Donating is good.
Yeah.
but also just, you know, connecting us with suppliers and resources. I think during Bunge was when we were, you know, the public really came in and assisted. They would connect us with their uncle who owns a 4x4 or who owns a boat. And he was willing to, you know, rent it out for us to use, you know, or, you know, if you have a friend who owns a pharmacy and who could basically donate a box of albendazole or furosemide, I think that would, so that's just in the context of donating, whether in kind or in, or monetary. Another thing that we encourage everyone to do is engage with our social media platforms. Our Instagram primarily. On Instagram, our account is DNG Malaysia. And through that, you would find links to everywhere, our Notion page, our Facebook page. You can just Google Doctors on Ground Malaysia or DNG Malaysia. Yeah, because traction and traffic really definitely play a hand in getting our content out further. To different people. I think another thing that people can do to basically support us is volunteer. You know, especially if you have a skill set that you think DNG could use, you know, by all means, volunteer. You can volunteer remotely, on ground. But basically participate in the industry. It's great to see so many diverse backgrounds kind of shift their skill set towards public service, towards humanitarian work. And at the end of the day, you can be a doctor, you can be a lawyer, you can be a graphic designer, you can be an architect, and you still have the skills to contribute back to society.
All right, before we wrap this conversation up, would you have a final message for us?
Yeah, I think it's so easy for us to get overwhelmed with a lot of the things going on, but I think you know, you are in your own capacity. You do have all the power to contribute to creating a world that you want to see, I guess, and it's a bit cringy. But once you kind of get involved in the very real problem that you yourself are advocating for, or you yourself are very vocal about, mm-hmm. it starts becoming less overwhelming and it starts making sense. So again, you don't have to come from a specific industry, or you don't have to have a set of skills to do something. I think taking that first step is the biggest courage you can do. And that's what I did with Doctors on Ground.
Thank you so much for speaking with me today, Arisa.
Thank you for having me.
That was Arisa Jemima Ikram. She's the founder of Doctors on Ground. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can check us out on podcasts. We're available on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Dashan Johan, and this has been Good Things, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.